and welcome back to the Earth on Survival Guide, the podcast for all disciplines, paths, players, and game masters, with your questers, Josh and Dan. I am Dan.
I am Josh.
And on today's podcast, discussing all things quizzical and trollical. I think it's almost the last part of the trollical, because we have more questions and emails to get to first, but we'll talk about the last troll moot, the fire scale moot here after emails. So if you have a question for us, please feel free to drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave us a voicemail. 168 episodes, we've only got three voicemails.
Yeah, that's fine. You can go to the show's website, which is now at spotifyforpodcasts.com rather than anchor.fm. They changed the name of it. I think if you still go to Anchor FM, it will redirect you. But now it's like Spotify for Podcasters. Search for EDSG Podcast, and there should be a link on the landing page there that allows you to send a voicemail, which is basically you record a little voice message and it delivers it to us.
Fair enough.
Or if you want, you can also like record it on your own thing and attach it to an email and just send it to us. That works too.
Yes. Yeah. We know how to import files. We're good. So, all right. Dear Josh and Dan, I live somewhere northwest Vivane province, perhaps Rugario. Hard to tell. Never played Earthdawn, but I own almost all the books because I love the unique setting and the excellent storytelling. The same reason I listen to your podcast. We have excellent storytelling. Well, Josh has excellent storytelling.
You tell good stories as well.
I'm just the unique setting. My question mostly to Josh is, do you know that virág, spelled virág, in Hungarian means flower? All the best and keep up the sterling work. Balázs.
I did not know that when I created the character. I did learn it later on when somebody told me that was the case, and it amused me because it actually seemed like a rather appropriate name for my troll Nethermancer from the Legends of Earthdawn podcast.
Absolutely.
So I thought that was cool, but I did not know that when I first named her.
Yeah. My question back to you is, how come you're not playing? You just can't find people to play with? Go on Discord or community somewhere and find a group. That's my guess. My suggestion. I don't know.
Yeah. The Earthdawn West Marches group, which is a community on Discord, there is a link to their Discord in our show notes every week. They have sort of rotating GMs and easy ability to drop in, drop out of games because they're generally set up as one shots or two shots. I've not actually had the opportunity to play with any of them, but they're I know some of the folks involved and they're pretty enthusiastic. If you don't have otherwise a location to play, that's not a bad one to look into, because I know there are members as well from Europe and whatnot that could make time zone conversions and ability to play together a little bit easier.
Agreed. Next, we have one from, it's a long one, Polythemus is back. Hello, Earth on Survivalists. Thanks again for answering emails and providing some feedback on ideas and concepts within the Earthdawn setting from my last slew of questions. The time you guys take to do this podcast has led to my attempt at getting back, perhaps foolishly, into RPGs, resulted in a bought group, and generally fired up a lot of creative juices with writing, acting, and general adult frivolity. The two of you should be lauded as the true greats in the Earthdawn pantheon. Well, Josh is the content guy. I just host the show. All of your feedback on Action Economy, Orichalcum Pillars, and the rest. While I'm waiting to do another campaign session, usually only about 1 to 2 months, I wanted to give you and maybe the other listeners the group story so far. Six adventurers received a mysterious summons to come to Bartertown, to the tavern Nectar of the Passions, run by Andros, a troubadour hailing from Isenthiar, who welcomed them all and began a rousing performance of his group's great victory over creatures of Kolnora, set to the tune of Ghost Riders in the Sky. Suddenly, a minotaur bursts through the wall, goring Andros with horns secreting elfbane poison. Five of our six heroes battled it fiercely while Timon the Elvish Troubadour hurled insults at it from a safe distance. I believe he taunted it once, and then a second time. The beast was brought low by a well-placed astral spear by the Tuskrag Nethermancer Vladaria. Upon its death, it revered it to human form, and the mystery began. They have met a delightful number of dwarves with Scottish accents, a hideous troll named Bosch the Beautiful, kind of stumbled through a second combat encounter and met Shadow Swift, who sounds something like Matthew McConaughey. Time of this writing, our heroes are next likely to set out for this venture conclusion to face off with the perpetrator, whose development of alchemical serum drawn from the veins of other namegivers is the only thing keeping his wife alive, delaying her transformation into a Jehuthra. I wanted to ask a couple more questions, starting with this one. You guys always introduce yourselves as questers. Who would you be questing for? It has always been slightly curious to me that more cities in Barsave don't have more affiliation with individual passions directly as city-states, with the possible exception of Trevar and Corollis. That source book is awesome, by the way. The corollary would be Athena and Athens, Sparta and Ares, but Thrall in the sourcebook material at least is not mentioned to have a particular affiliation other than having more prayer groups dedicated to Garlen than any other. Is this mostly to subvert the expected Eupandal link in the Elf Palace and Jaspreet?
Since both of those decisions were in earlier development, I think part of it was just to get away from the traditional D&D church pantheon kind of things that you were seeing in those late 90s days, with you essentially have church organizations similar to Christian churches or sects that we are familiar with today, but in a kind of pantheistic, we have actual evidence that the gods are real because they grant their worshipers magical powers, and just kind of getting away from that a little bit in some ways. The connection with Corollis for Trevar was something that was a development decision kind of made when that book was in early stages. But for the most part, other than the Mad Passions, a lot of places will have multiple sects or brotherhoods or whatever worshiping the various passions. And while in some places there may be more emphasis on one than another, like, for example, there's probably going to be, when I spend some more work on that part of it, in the Europa book, we'll have quite a bit of stuff tangential or related to Astendar because of the strong artistic community that I am sort of developing to go along with that city. But yeah, Thrall does have a kind of strong presence for Eupandal. They just don't have a single dedicated deity the way that we picture classical Rome or ancient Greece or things like that.
Fair. So who would you be questing for? I'm Astendar.
Golly. If I had to pick one, it would probably be Minbruge, because that's the one that has a strong dedication to truth and knowledge and stuff like that. You know, the reason that we call ourselves questors is because we are questors of Earthdawn. But yeah, I think for me as Josh, the actual person, it would probably be Minbruge. Astendar would be another potentially likely one.
I'm the same too, just in the reverse order. But yeah, I'm all about those. Okay, back to Polythemus. The other thing I have been doing is looking up ways to converting existing campaign content to Earthdawn. I'm trying to take your advice, Dan. Actually, this is Josh. In so doing, I was looking at D&D campaign books, and Curse of Strahd caught my eye. Open world, dark and atmospheric, vampires, werewolves, quests for redemption, what's not to love? But converting everything over to Earthdawn, oi, lot of heavy lifting there. There are a lot of ways that it could work. Make Strahd a human who becomes a horror through some dark pact. Amber Temple becomes a care. You can use the Izgarath as a template for Horror Strahd. Or maybe he's a Ristular and has accepted to host a Night Twist in some grand Faustian bargain. Umbra Stalker becomes template for werewolves. While researching, I stumbled across some old threads on the Earthdawn forums about wanting to do something special with blood magic and vampires as justification for there not being any in Earthdawn. Has there been any more thoughts about this? And if you were going to give your vamp powers, what would they be? I was thinking some climbing, some shadow walk type stuff, trust the illusionist spell, maybe horror mark is biting. I had thought that maybe the shadow escape and slip shades get with the associated weakness of being able to pin down thoughts. Again, thanks for the great podcast. With the dearth of Earthdawn related content out there, you guys are the kind of the only GMs I can bounce ideas off of. Love you guys. Polythemus.
So there was in the original first edition book, and it got replicated, I think, in second edition and possibly in classic as well. There was an example when talking about pattern items where the example was of a vampire, and that what you would need to do in studying it, you learned that it got repelled by garlic and that that might be something that is an important piece of the pattern information that you would need. But vampires were never a creature that was introduced with actual game stats in Earthdawn. And that was something that I seem to recall that Lou mentioned at some point back in the old days, that one of the potential issues when you talk about a vampire as we traditionally conceive of it is that because of the power of blood and blood magic, an entity that feasts on blood, you would need to think about how it would interact with that sort of thing. I don't recall whether in Scourge Unending, Living Room Games ever did sort of their own version of a vampire. I think to do a vampire in Earthdawn, you almost certainly would have to tie it into the horrors in some way as an undead creature. I don't know. I haven't really given it a lot of thought. I talked to somebody, gosh, a number of years back now. I think it was somebody that I spoke to at Gen Con about a possible way to seed the possibility of vampires in Earthdawn. And that would be perhaps a microscopic horror akin to the Dread Iota that infects a person, so that what's going on is the actual sort of horror itself, and controlling or puppeting or exerting its power and influence through whatever it is that they are doing through that corpse or construct or partially dead person. And I think part of this was trying to connect it with the human metahuman vampiric virus in Shadowrun to maybe come up with an explanation for how it could be very similar across both, and that the virus in Shadowrun is this now awakened but not fully cognizant horror type of infection thing that operates differently in different people. I don't know, but that seems like something that could be an interesting idea, but we haven't thought about it or discussed it too much. Similar to like, there aren't really traditional werewolves in Earthdawn either. I really kind of like the notion that if you're going to do a classic monster in that sense, that you need to Earthdawn it up in some way, that you need to find something that's a little bit different and twist it in the way that like the Cadaver Man has its own kind of unique twist on the classic zombie.
Yeah, make it setting appropriate.
With its frenzying and stuff like that, and finding something that can be uniquely tied to the Earthdawn setting to make it recognizable as what it is, but still be a surprise in some regards for people who encounter it. It actually would not necessarily be that much of a stretch to say that like a werewolf is someone that has been getting twisted into a construct in some manner by a horror that is kind of bestial and whatnot. And that could be the source of those legends and stories, because some of the things that go on in Earthdawn are, oh, this is where the source for these legends and stories come from. I mean, even the unicorn has an Earthdawnish kind of twist, where the pre-Scourge version of it was this horrific, murderous, whatever, which incidentally turns out to actually be something that was the case in really old stories about unicorns as well. They were not always the paragons of purity and virtue that we sort of conceive of them today.
On to one from Brendan. I have a question about the interaction between the talents, shield bash, melee weapons, and second attack. Shield bash states that it allows you to use a shield as a weapon once per round, but second attack states that you use the same weapon as you did on the first attack. Is it possible to use shield bash for the effect test of your first attack using melee weapons, and then follow up with the use of a second attack talent using your normal weapon?
No.
Also, what about the opposite?
Rules as written, no. Shield bash does not grant an extra attack, and because a shield is not a weapon, you can't then use another weapon as second attack, because its second attack specifies that it has to be the same weapon that you used in the initial attack, and you can't do that. Shield bash, as written, prevents the use of additional attacks outside of the bonus attack that you might get from air dance if your initiative is high enough. because it also doesn't allow, it's not compatible as written with second weapon either. What you are looking for is a knack in the companion called Shield Drive, which allows you to do a shield bash attack as a free action, which then essentially allows you to sort of get around those restrictions.
Fair. I think that's asked and answered. Brendan says, thank you for taking the time to answer the questions and putting them on the podcast. Thank you, Brendan.
Just a quick add-on. I suspect at this point, given how often the shield bash question comes up, because it comes up all the time, if Morgan and I were going back, we would probably rework it quite a bit to make it a little bit more clear as to how it's all supposed to work.
Fair enough. We'll wait for another. I'm just kidding. No other additions. We'll let it stand as
no additions are planned. New additions are planned at this time.
Okay. On to one from Anthony. I continue to love the podcast and appreciate your kind words or suggestions. I ran a second round of Earth Dawn demos. This round, I explained more about the legend to the players, how their power and influence grows based on how the world views them and their actions. I talked about the Library of Thrall and how logs could be turned in for a bit of coin, but also to expand their legend. Everyone loves threaded items. The most common responses I hear is how they would like to play in a campaign so they could explore the powerful items and draw out their powers. Overall, it has been a very positive response. The demo, The Vagabond Kins, the name I've assigned the group of adepts, were helping out their friend Francis Fairmont, the one who owns the Fabulous Fair. Since they helped him out with the troubles he was having, he requested that they travel a couple of days ahead of the fair and put down a deposit on a plot of land at the next village. They happily accepted and started the journey. After a few days, they came across a farmstead that had built a small hostel of sorts for travelers in the rural countryside. The family used it to supplement their earnings as well as to draw in news and gossip from weary travelers. During the night, they heard a crash and discovered that someone had tunneled beneath the floor of the family's house. Quick to help, they pulled the mother and father from the hole, but had to go save the son. After outrageous tracking rolls from the troll beastmaster, they discovered enough information to trigger a lore roll. They were facing ghouls. They rushed to get the child before the couple of ghouls could return to the pack. They managed to surprise the ghouls and eliminate one of them before they were able to defend. The combat was quick and decisive. The dwarven wizard was using Mind Dagger to make the targets easier to hit by the melee, and as a group, they worked well together. The second session, they arrived at the town of Woodford, and I ran them through the ritual of artisan skills to prove they were taint-free. The orc Sky Raider botched, but didn't do well. So they decided to provide a runner for the group in case they needed anything. Primarily, he was to report anything odd to the elder. Instead of taking the deposit, the village was having a problem with livestock going missing. If the group would help them, then they could keep the deposit. They investigated and discovered that there was a harpy in the woods. When they confronted it, they discovered it had a maimed wing, and that is why it was by itself and attacking any easy prey it could reach from the edge of the woods. I had that it could make large leaping motions with the aid of its wings, but could not actually fly. Harpies are normally a third circle challenge, and the group was a circle two. It was entertaining because the Tuskrang Swordmaster tried to taunt the harpy and got minimal success. They are very social, and it taunted him back and devastated him. He had to subtract 3 steps from all of his tests. It was a lot of fun, and as I grow the characters, I'll probably group patterns and introduce threaded items to bring more of the game to life, especially if I get repeat players. The Vagabond Kings shall rule the road. Anthony.
That is a fantastic story. I'm glad that you are continuing these demos and exposing the game to people in ways that introduce the cool stuff and the unique aspects without necessarily doing a huge lore dump on them. I think that's the best way to introduce the game. There is a lot of love, justifiably, for the expanded lore and setting information, but you don't need to know all of that or have read all of that in order to run the game or enjoy the game, as we have said in the past.
Yeah. Minimal investment. Go for it, man. Anthony does provide a follow-up. The next demo day that I will be running a game is on June 24th. It is coinciding with Free RPG Day. I haven't seen anything for a long time from Earth Dawn for these Free RPG troves. Typically, games drop a one-shot adventure or quick start rules. I just thought it might be another way to help spread the word about Earth Dawn. Just a thought. Thank you, Anthony.
Yeah, it's something that I've at least myself kind of looked into just to have interest on it. It's definitely not something that's in the cards for this year. We just don't have the production cycles to have that happen by then. The other piece of it is that if we were to do something like that in the future, it would pretty much have to be an electronic product only, because we don't have the funds or really the demand for there to be physical products that would be distributed to stores. We do have the free quick start rules with the Starter Adventure that are available for free, both at DriveThruRPG, at the FASA Games website. So those continue to be available. But I think most likely if, and this is a big if, we were to do something like that in the future, most likely it would be writing up a one-shot type of adventure and making it available as an e-product that people could download and run if they wanted to, perhaps with, depending on what was going on, doing sort of a new version of a quick start or that sort of thing. But
yeah.
I'm aware of it. I've looked into it. And with our limited development time and whatnot, it's the sort of thing that always sneaks up on us. And then it goes past and we forget about it again until it's like a month out and whatnot. Or at least that's my standpoint on it. And we've just got other books that we need to finish, much like my desire to have more fleshed out, written up versions of the one shots that I've come up with for Gen Con. It's the sort of thing that's on the wish list of projects to tackle, but there always seems to be something else that taking priority.
So thank you, emailers, listeners, one and all. If you are listening and have never written in before, we'd love to hear from you as well. Please drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. On to the second half of our episode. We've done troll moots before, but what we're going to do now is the last troll moot, because this is the last one. So we did emails first, and now the last troll moot we've got. Located in the Skull Mountains. This northern part of Barsave, these mountains are tall and very forbidding. They are, the upper reaches of these mountains, by the way, are very barren rock. They're like unlivable and hazardous. And even the foothills are harsh and bleak. So this is like the hardiest of the hardy mountains you're going to live in. And this is where the Firescale Moot resides.
The Skull Mountains, to put them in a little bit greater geographic context, are in northern Barsave, kind of right up against the northern edge of what is considered Barsave, just off to the west of Blood Wood, north of the Serpent River. Glenwood Deep, which we've talked about in the past, is kind of nestled up along their southern and southeastern slopes. They are near Iopos. They are sort of in Denerastus territory, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more a little bit later in this episode. But that's kind of where they're located. According to some fragmentary documents found in Utrecht that did manage to survive the Scourge, it does seem to indicate that the founders of Utrecht originally came from the Skull Mountains or areas up there. Exactly why they left is not made clear. It might have something to do with the fact that they wanted to find an area that was a lot more habitable than the Skull Mountains. But similar to how there were dwarf clans that migrated from the
Dolaris,
the other mountain range that is now blanking.
Havoc.
Nope. North. They're dwarves. Northeastern Barsave near. Nope. Not the Kalk Havoc. North of that.
Okay. Oh, the side of the mountains.
The Scytha Mountains. Thank you. I do not know why I was blanking. But yeah, that some of the founders of Thrall, of the dwarves that now dominate the Thrall Mountains, came from Scytha. There was some migration that happened ages and ages ago, and that there was a dwarf kingdom in Scytha that collapsed and had some problems as a result of the Scourge. We talked about them quite a bit in the Dragons episode, actually, that we did about Asante and Night Sky, because they are connected to the Scytha Mountains and stuff like that there. That's, I think, probably where we've talked about that region the most in previous episodes. But anyway, That's the situation.
Anyway.
And then the fire scales are the Trollmoot that inhabits those difficult and forbidding slopes and peaks of the Skull Mountains.
Absolutely. So this is the dominant moot, as they've either absorbed or eliminated all the rest. So they are, they do raid in airships, and they also raid with cavalry on the backs of fire scales, which makes them...
Which is where they get their name.
Yeah, where they get the name from. Also makes them incredibly formidable because, yeah, they're a two-tiered threat. Sky Raiders on airships and cavalrymen on fire scales.
Yeah, the fire scales are another aggressive clan. They're similar in some ways to the Bloodlords in that regard, but they don't have the orthodoxy that the Bloodlords have. If you go back to the episode where we talked about them, a big aspect of the Bloodlords as a moot is their very strict orthodoxy and cultural lore that are all wrapped up in their hatred of the Therans and hatred of the other moots and all sorts of other stuff. The fire scales kind of have that level of aggression, but without the strong Twilight Peaks Crystal Raider culture bound up in it. They are in some ways a throwback, perhaps, to earlier troll cultures. If you see them as the progenitors or the forebears or the area that the trolls of Ustrecht came from, then their culture is in some ways quite a bit older, and they had the cavalry and fought from the fire scales and other large beasts like that before they developed airships. They didn't develop airships independently. They got them later on after they had already been developed in the Twilight Peaks.
Fair enough. They are, to judge as to what you said, aggressive, because it is rumored that the fire skin moot, they will kill strangers on sight, just so you know. The other question is, no one is entirely sure when the fire scales acquired airships. There's a rumor that either Eupandel gave the an artisan a divine vision on how to build them, or maybe a dragon dropped by and gave them an airship. I just like that both of those prospects are just kind of cool. And has claimed the Skull Mountains since before the Scourge began. So they are entrenched in that region. It is theirs. Do not test them on it. They will come after you. But they, after they raided and controlled settlements into the lowlands, half with raiding and half with farming. So they are slightly developing another skill set other than just raiding and killing and pillaging on airships or cavalry. They're also farming, which I think is a nice twist.
Yeah, again, a little bit of a difference from their southern cousins in the Twilight Peaks and the Dolaris Mountains, most of whom have a little bit more of an aversion to working the land because of the sort of legend of Jaspri's blessing. There have been some cases, I think one of the Dolaris moots does a little bit of farming, as I seem to recall offhand, but the Twilight Peaks moots mostly got some mining done by the Black Fangs and by the Ironmongers, but broadly there is not a lot of agriculture. It's like the Fire Scales. They are a different culture. They are still sort of a recognizably Highland troll culture in some ways, but the development fork, if you want to talk about like a kind of pseudo evolutionary or anthropological development, the common ancestor, the point at which the Skull Mountain trolls diverged from the Twilight Peaks trolls, they have this one spur, and then the Twilight Peaks kind of goes one way and then branches out into the moots up there. So you've got this rather pronounced difference and different traditions and different beliefs and things like that. Of course, there is also, especially in the past several decades, the added twist of them being in the area that has been largely dominated by the Denarastis and Iopos. And the relationships that the Denarastis have formed with their neighbors in the area, the Fire Scale Moot, but as well House Ishkarat in the North Reach of the Serpent.
Yeah, because, yeah, to your point, this the Firescale Moot actually does have a tentative alliance with the Dunerastus of Iopos. It is mutually beneficial, but they will have no problem leaving that alliance if they need to.
Right. And there is some potential interesting discussion that could be had, or speculation that I think I might have mentioned in earlier episodes when we talk about the Dunerastus clan and the outcast and the whole thing that's going on in that northwestern corner of Barsave, is how closely related to the outcast's plots are the Ishkarat and the Fire Scales.
Yeah.
Are they being manipulated at a somewhat of a remove by the Dunerastus, or is there actually a stronger connection more directly between the outcast and these other communities up in that area? No firm answers yet, but it is definitely, if you've got a game that's going to be dealing with them, that might be something to consider, especially when you think about the fact that the outcast has a lair in the Skull Mountains.
Yeah.
Or at least so it is believed.
It's your Earthdawn. Put it in there if you want to. So as we've done with all the other moots as well, this one has 11 airships armed with fire cannons, dragon's breath, thunderbolt throwers, and they have something new, which is their alchemical munitions, because I think they've borrowed from what they've learned from the Iopans and the Dunerastus. So they've enhanced their wares as well. Doesn't say how many fire scales they have to ride as cavalry, but I'm assuming dozens, because that would be a large enough force to make it very formidable. So this Fire Scale Moot is led by Chief Martok Manslayer Firescale. If your middle name is Manslayer, I don't want to meet you in a bright alley, much less a dark alley. That's just me. He is an 8th Circle warrior who wears blood pebble, has a targeting eye, and liberally adorned with blood charms. This dude is hardcore. Just saying. Second in command is Norella Hardeyes Firescale. This is by line marriage. So Norella is
one of the co-wives, yeah.
She is a Quester of Thistonius, rank 10. But those are the first edition rules, so we may have to update the Quester rank. But also a 7th Circle Sky Raider. So also very formidable in this moot.
Yeah, it does mention that Martok is a very formidable opponent, and that Norella is probably one of the few members of the Fire Scales who could challenge him for chieftainship and win.
Yeah, which is why he married her.
Yeah. But it does say that she doesn't have any desire to be chief. Being part of the line marriage of the chief and being the highest ranking questor of Thistonius within the moot are enough for her. There is a little bit of political squabbling because she is one of the younger co-wives, and the older wives are a little bit jealous of her fame and position, and could perhaps, if you are trying to operate against them, be leveraged to act against their rival. You'd have to be pretty cunning probably to pull it off. Mm-hmm. That's what high circle social characters are for.
So the third person of note in this moot is actually not a troll. It's Gelid Dunerastus of the Gold Branch and the Holders of Trust, 8th Circle Illusionist, and 6th Circle Wizard. So, a notable spellcaster, but obviously the Dunerastus are slightly racist, human. So,
yes, he is the envoy to the Fire Scales from Iopos. He is likewise passing information back to the Dunerastus. He is able to impress the Fire Scale moots, particularly Chief Martok, through his magical prowess. And he is the one that is sort of promising Martok that when the Dunerastus conquer Barsave, they will give him more territory as his own kingdom, which is sort of giving the impression to me, at least from the information here, that at least the leadership of the Fire Scale moot is not directly connected to the outcast, that they are being manipulated and brought on as allies in the Dunerastus plot to defeat Thrall and conquer Barsave.
and all the other bad deeds they have going on.
And of course, in the usual one-upmanship games of the Denarastus clan, Gelad is hoping that his ability to parlay the Fire Scales as allies will be something that endears him to the family and gains him prestige. And obviously at the time that this book was written, to Uncle Ul to perhaps have him be named a potential heir to the Malachite seat.
Yes. Because there's always...
Things have probably changed when we get to the present day.
Fourth edition timeline.
Yes, fourth edition timeline.
So I like this as another aspect of what you could think of as a traditional troll moot, because A, there's a human involved. B, there's more political maneuvering with another outside organization than any of the rest of them, except maybe Stoneclaws, because they're loosely associated with Thrall and the dwarves and so forth and so on.
The difference there, though, is that the Stoneclaws had Thrallic dwarves that were brought into their communities prior to the Scourge and then got integrated. The Firescales don't have communities of humans that are part of the moot. They just happen to have this Denarastus envoy that has some degree of infamy amongst them and a certain amount of influence because of what he is able to do magically and the leverage and promises that he is making to the chief. So that is a little bit different. I mean, certainly the situation is right now that the Firescales are within the orbit of the Denarastus, and you will have them end up being part of a campaign, largely one that is going to be involving the Denarastus. It helps provide a little bit of variety in terms of the opposition and tactics and things like that that are able to be brought to bear in Denarastus plots. So you don't just have humans or members of the Silver Branch or things like that. You've got the Fire Scales both with their airships and their powerful cavalry. And then, of course, you also have the Ishkarat and their ability to work on the Serpent River and whatnot. So you've got various avenues through which the Denarastus are able to sort of exert influence and have plots that they are doing. I mean, one thing that is a fairly kind of straightforward idea that kind of fits the Denarastus skullduggery to a T, it would seem to me, would be to have the Fire Scales raiding an area to weaken it up, then have Denarastus or Iopan support come in to help drive them off.
Yes.
In order to sort of take over an area in a manner similar to how they manipulated things in Jarrus to put themselves in a position of power.
It's like a mafia protection racket.
Yeah, there is a certain amount of that going on. You know, we have talked about how when it comes to the broader Denarastus plans, the next community, the next large city, large certainly in this case being a relative term, but that Kratos would have sort of be the next logical target for them as an area to destabilize and or take over. And certainly having a force of heavy cavalry and airships to help support such activities would be pretty useful.
Agreed. So like I said, getting back to the first point, like I said, this is the one where the influence and the commingling is from external. Other moot had it during the Scourge with the dwarves. And so this is the juxtaposition of, well, okay, let's do this from an... So I just thought it was nice to have yet another take. We've done 9 different troll moots. They're all vastly different, and just 9 facets of the same diamond is awesome to take a look
really at. Really great. I've enjoyed going through this, and like we have with a lot of the other first edition books that I haven't really revisited in any depth in a while, reminded of why not only myself, but you and so many other people are fans of this setting because of the development and the diversity, especially later in the line, and the different things that are part of what makes Barsave fascinating.
Yeah. This is a really rich sandbox that I don't find in a lot of other games to this level.
Yeah. There's a lot of potential story hooks and ideas and balances of power that could shift a little way as a result of player character influence or by other groups acting on them and dragging. characters into their orbit in terms of stuff that's going on. So there is plenty of opportunity, like, depending on how you approach it, each of these moots that we've mm-hmm. covered so far could be the focus of a major yeah. story arc or an entire campaign, depending on how you're approaching it.
Play in the sandbox, folks. This is a fantastic book. If you don't have it, go get it. If you can't get it, try harder.
Well, it's available in PDF on DriveThruRPG as well as the FASA Games web store. There is both the original first edition version, which is what we've been going through, and I think there was a third edition version mm-hmm. as well. I think they yep. did the four setting books. They did Thrall, Serpent River, Carafod, and Crystal Raiders. So the third edition version has some updates for the post-Prelude to War era, because that's where that was set in the timeline. We didn't look at that at all, but that yeah. could potentially have additional ideas about what might be going on.
Yeah.
I mean, this is also in the post-Prelude to War era, so there might not have been a lot of change that was there, but there might be some mm-hmm. additional stuff that was added in.
Absolutely. And that's enough teaser for you to go buy both books. Because I'm here to push product. Like I get any royalties off of this. My name ain't Steve. So any final thoughts on...
Steve doesn't get any royalties, unfortunately, either. This was work for hire.
Exactly. So any final thoughts on the fire scale moot?
No. Like the Dalaris moots, there is not a lot of information about them here. Similar to the Denerastus, similar to House Ishkarat, they have enough information there to establish a baseline for probably what would have been further development in the future had they continued on with the first edition plans. Lou had mentioned that there were very, very rough ideas for one of the early post-war supplements to be called, he said it likely like Children of the Dragon or something like that, that was going to explore in a little bit greater depth Iobos and the Denerastus, House Ishkarat, and
the Fire Scales.
The Fire Scale moot. And this was just kind of setting in this book and then in Serpent River and Secret Societies, which was kind of up to this point the largest source of information about mm-hmm. Iobos and the Denerastus, all just kind of establishing a baseline as they were setting up the situation for the Denerastus to be the new primary villains of the setting after the war and the Therans were driven out.
Gotcha.
Which is why we are where we are in fourth edition.
Yeah, and that would have been a really cool book, but I think we're doing great. So until next time, folks, go ride a fire scale for your legend.
Good night, everybody.